Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome back. We're back. Welcome to the program, Speaking of Everything with Jeff Bushman. That would be moi. We were on hiatus for 3 long weeks, and we are back and hope to be back every week now. But now that we've lost 98% of our audience when 2 of you left. No, now that we've probably lost some of you, but hopefully all of you will come back. And as I said, we will be back every week. So welcome to our listeners around the world. I can say that with relatively assurance. I don't think we have any listeners in China or most of Asia, but we do have listeners scattered throughout Europe, the United States, and Canada. Desejo más personas en México y los otros países en el sur. And what I just said, I have no idea. No, what I just said was, and I hope to have more people in Mexico and other countries to the south, which was my way of demonstrating that I can't speak Spanish worth a whit, or squat, or some other expression you prefer. Anyway, on this evening's program in a little while, we're going to be joined by Larry Hancock. And Larry is an author, and I'll talk more about him in just a little bit. And we're just waiting for his call. So presumably that'll come in just a minute, and we'll have him join us at that juncture. For those of you who are new to the show, Speaking of Everything deals with politics and literature. Well, literature may be too strong, but writing and books and business and things of, as Arnold Schwarzenegger would say, things of that nature. And by the way, that was a much worse accent than the Spanish accent I had when I was trying to speak Spanish. So in case you're keeping track, we have 2 terrible accents that have already been on the show. So thank you very much. In the news since we last got together, there's just been an enormous amount of stuff dealing with Russiagate. And the thing that happened the other day that I just wanted to talk about a little bit before Larry joins us, that's interesting in my mind, is that Donald Trump kind of screwed himself on the, and you've heard about this, and I don't know if you've heard this analysis or not, but yesterday, first off, let's back up. He had exercised tremendous discipline in not talking about the Stormy Daniels case at all, which is great for him and his lawyers. Yesterday he said he knew nothing about the payment. If he knew nothing about the payment, then there was no consideration flowing from him to Stormy Daniels. Under the law, under the contract, you have to have consideration. If I want to buy your watch, I'll say, I'll buy your watch for $10 if you'll sell it to me tomorrow. And you say, yes, we now have a contract. Essentially, there are all kinds of exceptions and limitations to that. But we have a contract. If he didn't know about the $130,000 and wasn't his money, that's his assertion and Cohen's assertion as well, then there can be no contract between him and Stormy Daniels, because even though she gave him something, no jokes here, she gave him the agreement, theoretically, to not disclose, as soon as he says, I didn't pay her any money, I didn't give her anything for that, there's no consideration, and Cohen has no specific interest that could be contractually enforced. So that's going to be a fun deposition if that ever comes through. Anyway, just thought I would share that with you. Wanted to share a little bit of my history with you, and then we'll bring Larry into the mix in a minute. But I'm sure most of you remember where you were, if you're old enough, remember where you were when you heard, the conversation is always, I'll always remember where I was at the time I heard of Jack Kennedy's killing or the Twin Towers being knocked down on September 11th, whatever it is. But for me, on April 4th of 1968, I was living, but I was not yet 17. I was riding a motorcycle to commute to school and work throughout the San Fernando Valley and other parts of Los Angeles, frankly, because I couldn't afford a car. I liked riding a motorcycle, but it was principally because I couldn't ride a car. Late that afternoon, I was pulled up to a stoplight, and a friend of mine happened to pull up next to me in his maroon car that, in my memory, seems to have been enormous. Cars were larger then. We also didn't have radios on motorcycles in those days, and Paul, like most people in those days, had his AM radio on in his car, mainly because FM radio was mostly classical music and maybe a jazz station and a lot of silence. But he saw and recognized me on the bike, because many of us at that time didn't wear helmets because we were stupid. And he looked at me with a shocked look on his face and said, or that's what it sounded like. The light turned green. We both drove off. I never didn't find out until later that day. Well, what I was going to say is that it would have been a better story if I'd caught up to him at the next light and he had told me what was going on and I would have known. But in fact, that didn't happen. And it was later that day that I found out that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had been killed in Tennessee by a gunshot. Tonight, it is 2 days after the 50th anniversary of that assassination, which means, besides everything else that's really important, I'm getting old. But it also, more importantly, marks the return to our show of Larry Hancock, the co-author of a newly released book all about the assassination plot and the execution of that plot, and of course the execution of Dr. King. It's called, appropriately enough, Killing King, and it's available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and everywhere books are sold, with the exception of where I buy most of my books, which is Goodwill. Welcome back, Larry.
How are you, sir? Happy to be here.
Terrific. How are you? How did you like that introduction, including Goodwill?
Well, in a couple of weeks, you never know.
The nightmare of every author is the remainder table at Goodwill, right?
Yeah. That, if you're lucky, it's months and not days, you know. But
or years. I'm sure that. I've been in a lot of Goodwills looking for books. You'll be happy to know, and I've never seen one of yours, so that's a good thing. People don't buy them and they keep them. You know what I'm saying? They just hold on to it because they want to go through it again and want to make reference to it every time they hear something on the news. So how are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine. I'd be doing better, but we've had another winter front come through, and I'm just ready for spring, and I don't like this. So
I can understand. Okay, well, good. For those who don't know, Larry's in Oklahoma, and I want to touch on that in a minute about what's going on there, but as you and I had discussed previously. But, I mentioned something the other day, actually, I'm trying to remember, I think I was talking to my wife, but it could have been somebody else. Well, you know, we just had the official first day of spring a few weeks ago, March 20th or 21st, and I mentioned to her, there's an old song, I don't know if you're familiar with it, called It Might As Well Be Spring. And are you familiar with that at all?
Yes, I am. Yep.
Okay, good. That means I don't have to sing it for anybody. Anyway, in that song, the lyric says, I'm trying to remember, blah, 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 and it isn't even spring. It might as well be spring. It isn't even spring. I think I have spring fever, and it isn't even spring. Anyway, they only play that song right around the first day of spring when it is spring, even though the lyric talks about it not being spring. And it happens every year. It's a minor complaint, but it's something I've noticed now for years. Of course, most people don't listen to radio stations that play songs like that, but if they did, they would hear that song. And I'm listening through TuneIn Radio to stations around the world. That, in fact, happened again, because I do listen to that kind of music, but it's just very strange. Anyway, all that said, you have a cold front, and it's no longer winter.
It was in the 70s last week. It will be in the 90s next week, but at the moment, it's freezing.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Well, we've had high 80s, low 90s here in the Phoenix metro area, and I was told by someone who heard a weather report that I had not heard that next week we'll hit 100 for the first time in the year. But I can assure you it won't be the last. We get some pretty hot weather here, but the good part is it's rarely humid. Unlike where
I know
you are.
It's dry heat, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. When I first moved here, I kept wondering why people kept talking about, but it's a dry heave. When I finally realized that's not what they said. Anyway, before we get into the book, which I do want to do, and I read the excerpt that was on crimereads.com, if anybody wants to look at that. It's a book written by Larry and Stuart Wexler, and about the middle of the website page, crimereads.com, they have their book, and you can click on that and read a part of what I assume is the first chapter. And it's really compelling. It's very well written. I'm not saying Larry isn't hearing any of this, but it's very well written and very tightly moves you along. It's some really good dynamic writing. But beyond that, and it's fascinating. That's why it's so good. But right now, before we talk about that, I want to talk to you because you are right there in Oklahoma where they're having a teacher strike. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it finally got to what I call the breaking point. Just for reference, I served on a local school board for probably about 14 years, so I kind of had a chance to look at it from the inside. And we've had funding problems for a long time. Basically, it goes back to about 2008 when a decision was made, a political decision was made, and politics put two things into play. And one thing was that the folks in political power began to take a stance that there never would be further taxation, that they even passed legislation saying that you couldn't add a new tax without like a three-quarters majority vote. They literally moved to block any type of new tax in the state. And at the same time, they reduced taxes, not just general taxes, but specifically taxes on the oil and gas industry, and cut them considerably. So at the same time, they established the fact that there would never be any new taxes. They also gutted the state's revenue stream. And it sounded good at the time. I was a little cautious about that, but after you go through that for years and years and years, and you have population growth, and you face the fact that this is one of the lowest income states in the nation, it has some of the poorest health in the nation, which increases demands, it has one of the highest teen pregnancy rates in the nation, all things, if you look at the demographics, are going to stress social services, and we finally
I didn't mean to interrupt. I was just going to say that the reason for the teen pregnancy rate increase is because of the low income with no money. There's nothing else to do. But please go on.
And we don't even have broadband.
yeah, go ahead.
But when you put that together, the population is growing, the need for social services is growing. It's obviously a function of the dynamic I just described, and there's no new revenue. And on top of that, literally the folks in political power, and I've been wrestling with this and with my congressman, have literally refused to look at any alternative sources of revenue for years and years. And finally, the system just broke. It's now to the point where it's becoming dysfunctional. And the teachers have taken, to some extent because of the constraints on public employees and other people, the teachers have taken the lead and just standing up and saying, no, you have to do better funding. We just can't go on like this. And that's what's driven this teacher strike, and I think what's driving it, it was so blatant that all of these people in political power got together and did pass more taxes. Now, of course, the more taxes they passed were primarily on individual citizens. They very slightly bumped oil and gas production, but they've also, there are so many caveats and fine print in the revenue generation off that regardless of that, they didn't even take it close to where it would generate the revenue it had back in 2008. So the teachers are really saying, we appreciate the first pay increase that some of us have had in 25 years, but
that was the $6,100
still unfunded. I'm sorry, what?
That was the $6,100 they threw at them.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so they're continuing to strike, literally saying, you know, we appreciate that you helped us, but that did not help the crisis in school funding in general.
And it also didn't help us that much.
Well, no. I mean,
yeah,
it didn't, but they're pretty much grateful for anything they can get along those lines now.
One of the things that I was surprised to hear, by the way, we you know they're having trouble in Kentucky in terms of teachers trying to get more money, and they had a strike in, was it West Virginia, that they got resolved recently? Here, they're strikes are illegal here. Okay, public employee strikes are illegal. And the state is the entity that pays teachers. Where I grew up, it was mostly local school boards that made decisions on salaries. Here, this is very weird. In the Phoenix metro area, you can almost, not almost, there are places where it's true. You have one school in a school district. Another place you have three schools in a school district. In another place you have one or five. You know, but there's no, I mean, there is one, but large school district. But for the most part, there's a lot of individual local school districts with the idea of local control. What it doesn't take into account is it also adds a lot more expense to the, you know, administrative side of it. And the teacher salaries are controlled by state government, which I believe is true where you are as well.
They are. It's an interesting thing. State government sets the salary guidelines.
Okay.
They don't necessarily fund them. But in other words, if you're a teacher with a certain amount of time or education degree, you should be falling within certain levels. But they don't. The school districts are still responsible for coming up with a good portion of that pay.
Right. Well, for the most part, the teachers are paid by the state, or at least the funding goes from the state. So it is to the state government that they are appealing here. They're not very appealing, I presume, but that's to whom they're appealing. So they set out their demands, and their first demand was for a 20% pay increase here, which isn't going to happen, but they hopefully will get something. But the thing that was really striking to me, and I should know better because both my brother and sister-in-law were teachers in California, both of whom are retired now, but it strikes me as very strange that not only do teachers go out of pocket for supplies, you know, erasers, chalk, you know, anything. They just go out of pocket and they get supplies for their kids. But that it's become kind of expected that they'll do that, which is crazy. I mean, I cannot imagine. That would be like my going to work in an office and the boss expecting me to buy the paper clips myself.
It has become expected. The other thing that is kind of amazing in a way, it's also expected that the local community every year will do some site of fundraising for school supplies for the kids. In our local community, our church does it. In others, different organizations do it. But not only are the teachers buying supplies for the classroom, so is the local public, you know, totally outside of the education funding system. And that's just become the way it is.
You know, I have mixed feelings about that. On the one hand, I'm thinking, well, you know what, that's fine. That's really like community involvement. On the other hand, if that is the expectation or the requirement by virtue of starvation level funding, then what ends up happening is that relatively wealthier communities have more in their public schools than do the poorer communities, and that's not what public education is supposed to be.
Oh, and that's absolutely true. And, of course, what none of that can do, okay, that might get you some teacher supplies, some classroom supplies. It might get you some kids supplies for the kids. It doesn't get you chairs or books. Teaching aids. You know, we've kind of advanced in technology, so the subjects that we're teaching would be well served by having – some better teacher age than just chalk and a blackboard. You know, but none of that fundraising can cover that. And certainly, as you say, this varies by greatly. And I know of no community that can even make up the differential. They do it.
Oh, no.
But they certainly don't cover the gaps. And, of course, the other big drive in Oklahoma has been to use public funds for private schools. And
yeah, they do that,
that
everywhere
puts immense
now.
Pressure
religious
on
schools.
Two ways. Yeah, they don't have to take, you know, they get to select the students they want. They don't
mm-hmm.
have to do the special needs
right.
work that the public system is charged with and is very expensive. And
uh-huh.
they can pay their teachers whatever they want to. So
right.
the public school system is under pressure from a number of directions.
Yeah, although I will tell you something else. A lot of the charter schools and private schools, at least from what I've seen, and I don't pretend to be – first off, I'm not as broadly based as you are, and because you have a school board background, I also don't have kids or grandkids in school now, so I'm not directly involved. But what I was going to say is that my impression is that the private and charter schools pay their teachers, as a rule, less well than public schools do. Because a lot of those folks cannot qualify for public school teachers.
Here they definitely pay them,
I will say that.
And the other thing that's going on, since you bring that up, actually the reverse is happening here. The teachers are so underpaid that virtually no teachers are graduating from state schools in education. And when they do, they immediately
they
go out of state. I just talked to our principal. Our principal was recruiting science teachers from a regional college. There was one graduate that would even be interviewed by maybe 20 schools in the area. That's it.
Wow.
And so the competition for teachers is immense. And I think I can't quote the exact numbers, but two or three years ago you can get special approvals, emergency approvals, to put a non-trained person in the classroom.
Right.
There were a couple of hundred of those statewide. I think now there are 4,000.
Presumably they can pay them less.
They can pay them less.
Stick.
And, of course, they don't necessarily have any teacher trained nor any academic credentials.
Right, and no options to go elsewhere, which is why they'll
correct.
Stay.
Correct. Yeah.
Right, here...
I was thinking about that myself.
Yeah, lots of people here who are teachers every year leave and go somewhere else where they can get, you know, a living wage. I mean, there are people here, and I'm sure it's true where you are too, they'll teach full-time, but they'll have some part-time jobs, one or two part-time jobs.
That's quite common.
You know,
they or
can't make
they're
a
on relief. You know, they really are.
Yeah.
A number of teachers in Oklahoma have to get... food stamps and different types, they're below support levels. So it's pretty pitiful.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's similar to employees at Walmart, but that's a whole different subject. But, I mean, what they're doing in those states where they are essentially starving their teacher employees is that they are saying to the rest of us, okay, you guys go ahead and give them Medicaid. You guys go ahead and give them welfare. Because we're not going to pay them enough. It's up to you to help support our employees. And also, you mentioned the other thing, the fact that the teachers are doing something very, smart tactically, but also smart humanly, which is they are not saying, just give us more money. They are saying, and the same thing is true here, give the support staff more money and get us books. They showed, and I think it was from Oklahoma, they showed video of a teacher holding up a book that came from an actual classroom, taped together, right?
Yeah,
and you
some
know
of
they're
the
old,
class,
but they can't be current.
Some of the books that talk about the latest technology being facts.
Right.
one comment you mentioned, just, to reference Walmart, one big difference here is, of course, the Walmart employees, unlike the teachers, are paying off 50 to 100,000 plus school loans on top of all this, which the Walmart employees are normally not burdened
typically
with.
Typically are not, crazy. Okay, well, now that we've covered the teacher situation and education, let's talk about the book. First off, the book just came out how long ago?
It was released on April 4th.
Perfect.
So it was
released
on the anniversary. Yeah, first book I ever got out early. It's been available for pre-order on Amazon for some time, a few weeks, but it's now available as of the 4th, correct?
Right. And so I assume it's too early to have any kind of sales figures yet.
We won't really. It's It's doing okay on Amazon. I think it's coming in right now on like between 20,000 and 30,000 on Amazon, which is okay.
Excellent.
I mean, for a history book.
I think it's
book.
Better than okay.
Yeah.
No, seriously,
keep our
better than okay.
Realistic.
Yeah. Well, you know, you and I have discussed this before on the show and off. The average book that's in a bookstore in America, right, sells approximately 12 copies. 12 copy. Give me a second. 12 copies a year. Now,
yeah.
That includes
yeah. Mm-hmm.
That includes, you know, some averaging in of the Stephen King books, right? And it also includes the guy who sold the book on the love habits of Snipes, and you know, who sells one book every 3 years, you know. But and it doesn't take into account the concept of a long tail, which means basically you can get any book you ever wanted online, which you couldn't do prior to the internet. You had to, you know, if you wanted a book, you either had to get it when it was in print and current, or you wouldn't be able to get it. Now you can get anything. But 12 books a year is average. So if you're selling 20,000-30,000 effectively in 2 days, that's amazing. I say that too. My book, by the way, if anybody who wants to read my books, you can look my name up and you can start with the book The Mobile Millionaire on Amazon. But the thing I was going, that was my quick, if you notice that sneaky commercial I just did.
That was good. I only have to correct one thing, and it depresses
yeah.
me to do so, but I may have misspoken there. The ranking on Amazon is around 20,000 some, which means probably translates to 100 to 200 books. So,
okay,
you know,
well,
I wouldn't want anyone to.
Okay,
that's
not as good as 20,000 to 30,000, but it's still pretty good, especially in 2 days.
I would take that,
No, because I hadn't gotten to the point of saying, so you saved me that, but I was going to say, that's like bestseller status. That's amazing. you know, but 100 to 200 in a couple of days, seriously, and the amount of publicity it's had has been limited, let's be honest, you know, to this point. You know, that's amazing. That's fabulous. I was going to tell you that I don't read them, but every month I get a statement from Amazon about the books that I have up as e-books, and there are three of them. And we sell, well, let me see, last year, because I got the 1099, we sold 100 books last year, all of last year. And I'm thrilled because none of them is brand new. And, of course, it beats books in a bookstore, the average books in a bookstore. That's not bestseller status by any stretch of the imagination, but I'll take it any day of the week. And if you've done that much in a couple of days, I mean, again, there are many, many differences between our books. For one thing, yours are printed. But outside of that, and frankly, in my even in my mind, you've got more interesting subjects. But but seriously, that's really quite good. And you have every reason. How does that compare with the other books you've had up before in that small space of time, 2 days? I assume it's better.
That's comparable. I mean, first looking at the first week sales for my history books, like Shadow Warfare or Surprise Attack, that's comparable. And those kind of sales last for maybe a week upon release, and then over the they have a like a 3 or 4 year lifetime.
Yeah.
But truthfully, the life for these kind of books, I and the publishers are happy if we sell between 4,000 and 5,000 copies.
That's very good, though. I mean, again, it's not Stephen King, but it's pretty good. And
for history books, that's pretty
decent. Yeah. And so, let me recommend to those of you who are listening, either live or in podcast version, that you join that group and be part of a relatively small but growing number of people who are reading Larry's books. And you co-wrote this one, as you have a couple of others, with Stu Wexler.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And he does a lot of the research, and then you do most of the writing, or you combine on the writing?
We combine. Stu, I do a lot of the document research, the archival research. Stu does more of the field work. He's made numerous trips to Mississippi, Georgia, Alabama, interviewing people. He does a lot more phone interviews than I do.
Mm-hmm.
I probably do the majority of the writing. we both do that, and then the editor does what, you know, we should have done. But, you know, so.
Yeah.
it's a joint effort, but Stu, for the listener, Stu teaches advanced political science and political history in high school. He has a master's degree, and he's very much into some of the political science and sociology aspects. I tend to be more into the history and some of the criminal aspects of this one. And
mm-hmm.
I got very much involved in the connection between the racist group that originated the bounty and Dr. King and the Dixie Mafia folks that you read about in the first chapter,
right.
Some who came out of Oklahoma and Kansas.
Yeah.
One of the things that was fascinating is we found a lot more about these people in going into the crime files, the attorney general's files in Kansas and Oklahoma than we did in the South, but that's because they're sophisticated enough. This network of criminals
mm-hmm.
were also referred to as the traveling criminals, and
right.
they would not do crimes where they lived. They would network
right.
across multiple states and trade jobs. And so
right.
we have guys living in Kansas that are doing armed robberies, armed burglaries, and killings in Georgia, Mississippi, and Louisiana.
And vice versa.
Right, correct.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's get into this a little bit. That chapter starts out talking about, well, backing up a step, you know, when this last murder happened in Florida, the last mass murder happened in Florida, there was a lot of conversation about things that the FBI missed that they could have followed up on and thereby prevented that killing by the guy at the school. And your book talks about what the FBI, and this is not finding fault necessarily, but what the FBI, had they followed up on this in the proper way or in a diligent way, could possibly have either prevented or seriously delayed the killing of Dr. King, because they had heard about the bounty that was out on him. Talk a little about how that came about.
Yes, and basically, to cut to the chase, the point is, beginning in 1964, a very violent group in Mississippi known as the White Knights, the Ku Klux Klan in Mississippi, had begun offering bounties on Dr. King's life for reasons that we go into the book, far different reasons than you might suspect. But in any event,
not just because they were racist.
Not just because they were racist. There was actually a very radicalized religious component to it. Their leader was committed, along with a number of other people, to creating a full-scale race war. And the reason they were targeting Dr. King was he was one of the few remaining advocates of nonviolence, and they felt that by dramatically killing him, that would spur black-on-white violence, which would in turn generate a lot of white-on-black violence. It would lead to martial law, to race riots, whatever. So they saw him as a very special opportunity. They had let a contract as early as 1964, which had been picked up by a guy operating out of the Tulsa area of Oklahoma. And he actually had traveled down to shoot King a sniper-type attack. The only thing that prevented that from happening is these guys failed to come up with the cash at the right moment, and he refused to take the job without cash in hand.
He was not a credit killer.
He was not a credit killer. These guys are very serious. It's like, you know,
yeah.
this is business, and, you know, show us the money. And
right.
there was a relationship between this particular clan and the Dixie Mafia for a number of things. They bought weapons
mm-hmm.
from them. They contracted bombings and certain other assassinations with them. So there was a long-standing relationship. Well, basically, after that failed, the guys, the clan, the White Knights, tried to organize a few attacks on their own. They aborted for various reasons, but by 1967, they were under immense pressure from the FBI because these were the same people that had done the Mississippi burning killings of mm-hmm. the civil rights voter registration folks. And they had been infiltrated. They had been indicted. Several of them had been convicted and were just appeal on appeal. So they were at the point where they were just way too visible to carry on this kind of activity. So they turned
right.
back to contracting. And what had happened is they also had some connections to some people in Atlanta, Georgia, who actually had raised a substantial amount of cash. And they were able to truly fund a $100,000 bounty on Dr. King. And that bounty offer was circulated to professional criminals and repeated inside this network and actually appears in two or three federal penitentiaries, including the penitentiary where Ray was, and another penitentiary where friends of this fellow from 1964 happened to be in prison in Kansas, and they heard about the offer. And it's an interesting thing because the FBI was made aware of the offer because the offers were being repeated to criminals who were about to be released who were going back to Atlanta, Georgia. And they were told
because
that
theoretically they could have taken advantage of it and carried it out.
That's right, and they had contacts in Atlanta, and it was going to have to be done very low profile because King had been threatened and attacked before, and so there was a lot of sensitivity. So you had to use people that didn't appear to be out of place, and so
right.
one of the people that we approached, who's still living, who we interviewed at length about this, was approached, and he was told that he was going back to Atlanta, and he could participate in two ways. For $20,000, he could simply serve as he could stalk King, keep King under surveillance, report on his movements, basically support role. Or there was a role for $100,000 to actually murder King. They didn't really see him in that role. They were looking for people with more experience than he had. The interesting thing is that scared him to death.
Sure.
The people that were making the offer were hardcore racist criminals. He didn't want anything to do with it. So he didn't tell them yes, but he also didn't tell them no. And
right.
when he got released, he did relate this story to the FBI, who did a very superficial investigation. They didn't even go back to this prison and interview the guy who... The person they interviewed, this fellow, Donald Nissen, was given some contacts, cutout type contacts that he would have to go
yeah.
through if he was interested. And they went and interviewed one of them, which in classic FBI practice, you know, is so literal. It's like I show up at your door and I ask you, you know, we've had a report that some of your friends are about to kill someone. Would you like to comment? And
right.
generally, that is not, you know, an open-ended question that gets a lot of response. So
right.
they didn't get any response, and they just closed it off. Because I think one thing people don't realize is the FBI, as an investigative arm, primarily investigates crimes that have been committed.
Already take place, right.
That's what they do for the Justice Department. So they may check out a threat or something like that, you know, do due diligence. But it's usually superficial because they've got a desk full of work on crimes that have already happened.
And, of course, there were lots of rumors about people wanting to kill King, so it wasn't like this was anything that out
right.
of the blue.
Right. So,
and there were a lot of false reports, too.
If they'd asked the right connections, if they'd looked at the, interestingly enough, They did not even come up with the fact, which we did, that this lady that they were talking to, who was the cutout, had been visiting this criminal in the federal prison routinely. He had lived with her in 1964. I mean, they didn't check out any of these connections. So they didn't see what we can see now. In any event, to make a long story short, this bounty was live again in 1967, and it was being relayed to certain people, and that is basically the trail that we followed until we could connect it up to Memphis, to the money
mm-hmm.
out of Atlanta, to the cutouts, and ultimately to James Earl Ray. And one of the things that we found in this new book was we found the fact that another person who had been in jail with James Earl Ray and knew about the bounty officer and admitted that to the FBI had moved back to Atlanta, and shortly after he had gotten out in the winter of 1967, just by sheer circumstance, he had decided to take his family to Los Angeles for a trip, and
yeah.
he took him to Los Angeles, and then he dropped out of sight for 2 weeks. And we think the chances are pretty good that he was looking for his old buddy who had escaped from prison, who had experienced, had talked about this bounty officer to fellow prisoners before he left jail. And the strange thing, the ironic thing is, he talked to one young fellow who was going back to Atlanta. He said, "Hey, you know, these guys are circulating this bounty. You're getting out. You're going back to Atlanta. I'm in for virtually for life. Why don't you take a shot at it?" And, of course, then within months, Ray manages to escape from the prison, so he's back in play.
Right. Before you said that there was this guy who is still alive, I had written myself a note to ask you, are any of these guys still alive? Are any of the people who... not obviously James Earl Ray, but there were a lot of people who, enabled the plot in one form or another, either by creating the money, you know, paying the money over or any of these things, or getting the equipment and getting everything set up. Are any of these people still alive? And if the answer is yes to that, why haven't they been prosecuted?
Well, I think, and certainly, well, there are two answers. The fundamental answer, and actually, Stu actually had a chance personally to talk to a senior person at the Justice Department about this. You have to understand that the King assassination is a closed case. James Earl Ray was convicted. There is nothing. It's not an open case, and it's virtually the only so-called cold case. I mean, it's not cold to the FBI. It's done. Stu's gotten actually legislation introduced to address that. It will go nowhere in this administration. Anyway, long story short, so that's one reason. The second reason is Donald Nissen, the person we're talking about, would be happy to talk to people, but legally, there's no case to talk to him, and that's just not happening. There's another gentleman who actually even admitted that he, in California, bought a rifle to bring back to this White Knights group that was going to be used to kill Dr. King. He is alive. We've named him. We've tried to talk with him. We don't actually, strangely enough, we don't feel that he was an enabler per se. We feel that he was kind of a pawn, and actually following the assassination was set up as a patsy in the event that the FBI had pursued the conspiracy and gone beyond Ray. They were willing to sacrifice this young man. But he's not interested in talking to us. He may or may not still be under witness protection. He's That's another story entirely. We don't know. We can't see the files that would show us that.
But you were able to penetrate the witness protection to at least find him.
We found him because he's named in all of this. He surfaces in the investigation. As a matter of fact, he was one of the first when they were looking for the people that. Bought the rifle that killed. He was among the first half a dozen pictures that were shown as being the probable assassin.
Wow.
So his name comes up all in all of this early on and frequently. He was definitely a major bomber for the White Knights, committed a number of bombings. You know, so there's no doubt about all of that. It is pure speculation that he may have provided information to the FBI at some point in time that they are protecting. He's certainly not in witness protection because he's a very visible public citizen.
Okay.
And by his own name and significant religious figure.
Wow.
So he's not... But the fact that he may or may not have been an informant to some extent on the White Knights, we will never know because those records are protected.
Yeah, just checking now. You're not saying this is Pope Francis, right?
No. He's safe. This person would have something of a different accent.
I know. But when you said that he was a significant religious figure, that's the first thing that popped into my head. And, of course, Billy Graham
different,
is dead.
This would be Protestant.
Yeah, I know. There aren't too many white Southern racist Catholics. I'm sure they're there, but that's not the predominant group in that part of the country.
This is true.
Yeah. No offense to all of the Protestants in the audience. But anyway, that's funny. But in terms of these other folks, so he's alive, and the fella who you mentioned at the beginning, Donald Neeson, who's the guy who went to the FBI in 67, mm-hmm. after... having been approached in the prison, this is the guy they didn't listen to but should have. Other than the two of them, are there any principals that are still around that you know of?
No, that's really it. The other people were in their 30s, you know, in 1968. They are pretty much long gone. There are a couple of peripheral figures or relatives of peripheral figures that are still around that we have talked to, but nobody that would have been deeply inside the plot is still alive.
Yeah, that's too bad. I mean, not that they, you know, I don't, these are not people that I necessarily wish to have ongoing life, but it's too bad that A, you can't talk to them, and B, and perhaps more fundamentally, that the police or FBI can't talk to them. Do you think that the FBI... part of the reason that they didn't follow up is because at that time, it's much less true now from what I understand, but at that time the FBI was pretty much rife with racism, particularly in their southern field offices.
You know, strangely enough, what we found was exactly the opposite.
Really?
And we've talked to a number of FBI agents, looked at a number of the reports. I'm going to focus this just strictly on Mississippi and the White Knights that we're talking about, not the South in general. But I will tell you that in Georgia and Alabama, we found records where the FBI literally identified for states' attorney generals and provided them list of hundreds of law enforcement figures that were known Klansmen.
Wow.
And, of course, the states did nothing about it. The FBI was actually doing their job far more seriously than you might think, but their job was simply to investigate and provide information. If the governor was a racist, if the attorney general or the head of the state patrol was, it didn't really matter. But we talked to, and we can see their reports, this, in Mississippi, it literally became an outright war between the FBI and the White Knights. The White Knights went after their families. They went after them personally, confronted them, threatened them, beat them up, and the FBI agents in turn took it very personally. And this was literally about, we're trying to keep these guys from doing bad things. They're going after us personally, and their orders were to do whatever it takes to shut these guys down. And they did. They did an excellent job of infiltrating. I mean, one of the reasons the King assassination came about as it did was that they had shut down these groups to the extent that they had to go outside for help.
Right. By the way, the white...
I would just say, very much opposite of what the perceptions might be in some of this. I mean, we've talked to FBI agents who wanted to nail these guys' hides on a wall because they were really bad people. And the FBI agents were local people, too. there were obvious, there were local sheriffs. I mean, the other thing that started happening, it wasn't just on blacks. These guys were bombing Jewish synagogues, blowing up. I mean, they were as anti-Semitic. They were tearing communities apart in a number of ways.
Wow. Well, let me share with you a couple of thoughts real quick. One is, I'm surprised by what you say. I believe you, but I'm surprised by what you say because, you know, the old expression about, what's the expression, a fish rots from the head? You know, when you're talking about racism or antagonism to racism, J. Edgar Hoover was the head of the FBI, who was a racist. He had other lovely qualities, too. But but he was a racist, so it's a little hard. And when you say their orders, their instructions were to do what they needed to do to get rid of these guys, to, you know, or to blunt them, I believe you. It's just it's contrary or counterintuitive relative to what J. Edgar Hoover was all about. And the other thing was a question, which is you mentioned both in the book and while we've been talking, the white knights of the Ku Klux Klan. Is that separate and apart in any way from the regular Ku Klux Klan that was in Mississippi at that time, or was that the same thing?
Oh, very much so. These were very much a different type of people. They were a spinoff. They had alliances to several of these groups were divided and had inner circles and were quite compartmentalized, and the most violent cadres inside them were very much different than the general clans, who, you know, were violent, but it's totally different. These guys were affiliated with the people who did the Birmingham church bombing.
Right.
They were affiliated with on an individual basis, not on a clan basis.
Right.
Again, they would trade off killings and bombings with people like that. So, totally different. And we're talking about a relatively small number of people.
Right. Splinter.
You know, dozens at most. And their numbers had been dwindling. So very much a separate group from the Klan in general. But I think I can resolve the point about Hoover. Hoover was not really the instigator of this FBI pressure. Hoover had really not wanted to become involved. He didn't see these crimes as federal crimes. He didn't whatever. But after the Mississippi Burney murders, Lyndon Johnson literally called Hoover in and said, "You will put a stop to this in Mississippi. No ifs, ands, or buts."
Okay.
And it was a direct order from Johnson that Hoover could not refuse. So basically, he simply issued an order to the adjacent field offices and said, "Stop it." And then he was not involved. He had kind of put the monkey on their back. And it was those local field offices that took the task. So when I say the pressure was on, they got the assignment, and they carried the ball themselves. The ongoing pressure wasn't out of D.C. They got it, like it or not.
Yeah. Huh. Interesting. So are you working on another book right now?
Oh, there's another book that will be out later this summer, actually, that's already through the editing process, and it's just a matter of when it gets out. So that'll be two books for me in 2018, and time for me to take a rest. That's a bit of a different book. Its title is Creating Chaos: Political Warfare from Truman to Putin.
Really? Okay, that does sound like fun.
And it gets very contemporary.
Yeah, I'm surprised you used Putin instead of, you know, somebody else that could have been mentioned.
Well, this is a balanced book. It's companion to Shadow Warfare. Basically, I look at both American political warfare and Russian political warfare. Most of the American political warfare is during the Cold War era. The Russian is the new Russian political warfare, which starts around 2008.
Mm-hmm.
Two kind of different animals. The agonizing thing is that the Russians have taken everything the Americans have done, and they're demonstrating that they can do it better.
As you say, they're goosing it up, putting it on steroids.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
so
the book... Yeah, go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, that's going to be a very different book. It's much broader, more contemporary. Killing King is... Killing King, I think, as you read it, I think the readers will... I can truly claim that nobody has done this level of what you would call criminal legwork. We took the FBI leads and investigations and really carried it down. So this book is intended to read not like a crime novel, but more like a true crime book than a history book per se.
Than a history book or a politically oriented book. It is, in fact.
Right.
Yeah, that's what, you know, it's kind of like, it was called Killing King, but it could have as easily been called Stalking King, because that's what this is really, that's what this is really about, in the sense that, I mean, obviously, you know what it's about better than I do, but I'm saying that certainly in terms of the reading that was part of that first chapter, besides being very compelling, is... really does read like a true crime book. Okay, here's what happened with this guy. Here's what we learned. This is what happened next. And it's I'm not here to praise, but I'm saying, but it really is a very tight bit of writing, really very well done. And I don't get compliments like that easily.
Well, I appreciate that. And I think the other thing that's different is I think people will be, and of course this is just our conclusion. We can't prove it at the end. But I think people will be somewhat shocked because we think that what happened in Memphis is not what the actual plotters wanted to happen in Memphis. In looking at all of the details of Ray's behavior, the detail of the shooting, all the loose ends, it's our conclusion that the plotters actually wanted to kill Dr. King in a very cold-blooded fashion, in the middle of the crowd on live TV as he was leading the march, and that Ray actually jumped the gun.
In a manner of speaking, yes.
But
no, and not just
no
that.
Point,
not, yeah, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say that makes perfectly logical sense, particularly in light of the fact of all the stuff that Ray did in terms of his traveling and everything afterwards. It does not look, I mean, there are people who say, how is that possible? Where do you get the money for that? And it looks too organized. The truth of the matter is, as you showed in your last book, and as I assume it shows here, Ray did not actually operate like a logical, intelligent criminal. He acted kind of like a scatterbrain.
He's way too spontaneous.
That?
No, he's way too spontaneous. That's why he always got caught. I mean, bottom line is he could do a fairly good job. The interesting thing is what happened in Memphis is actually the opposite of all his previous crimes. He could plan a fairly decent robbery and did some robberies, and he always got caught in the escape. It's like, as soon as he started doing the actual thing, it all fell apart, and he fell apart and did the wrong thing. Well, in Memphis, there's no evidence that he planned to shoot King at that point in time. Otherwise, I mean, he took everything out of the trunk of his car and put it in his motel room. Now, if you're going upstairs to shoot King, you leave it in the trunk of your car. You know, it just makes no sense. It's not... It doesn't appear that he planned it at all, and he acted very spontaneously. And truthfully, he only got out of there, from our calculations, approximately 2 minutes before the police blockaded the street in front of the motel where he was.
Amazing. Larry,
so
we're
was...
out of time.
Oh, okay.
Sorry about that.
I understand that.
I'd like to pick this up another time. We'll talk some more and schedule, not so much for this one, but about the next one. In the meantime, everybody, we have 60 seconds. LarryHancock.com and Barnes & Noble and Amazon for Killing King. Thanks, Larry. Talk to you soon.
Thank you, sir.
All right, and good night, everybody. Take care and be kind to each other. Bye-bye.